Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. The entire U.S. Senate was summoned to the White House for a briefing on Korea yesterday afternoon, fueling speculation that Trump could be getting ready to attack North Korea. As the United States and South Korea said the THAAD missile system would be operational within days. Donald Trump has released a tax plan, well, not really a tax plan, but at least talking points that proposes sharp cuts for businesses and those who return overseas corporate profits to the U.S. But what does this tax plan mean for working people in the United States? The semi-annual summit of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, begins today in Manila and is a milestone in President Rodrigo Duterte's controversial presidency. But first, we turn to Korea. We are joined from New York by Ben Norton. He is a journalist currently with Alternet's The Gray Zone Project. Welcome back, Ben Norton.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, the Republicans and now the Democratic minions of Donald Trump were summoned to the White House yesterday to get a briefing from their leader about the crisis in North Korea, a crisis which I consider to be absolutely manufactured by the United States. A few people were out there, including myself, protesting against this gathering. The Secret Service tried to shut down Pennsylvania Avenue because we constituted apparently a national security threat. But when people refused to leave, they sort of backed down. But it was an interesting thing. I guess what they were mainly wanting to do, Ben Norton, is to sort of sanitize Pennsylvania Avenue and make it appear that Donald Trump has the support of everyone, Democrats, Republicans, etc., as he escalates this confrontation with North Korea. It's getting pretty dangerous.
No, absolutely. This is incredibly dangerous, and people should realize what's happening. But unfortunately, there isn't much discussion. And when there is discussion, it's really a caricature. The nuance with which the media discusses North Korea or the DPRK in this country is abysmal. I mean, there is no nuance. They portray it as a cartoon regime where millions of people just blindly follow orders like ants. And by dehumanizing these millions of North Koreans, the media is helping the government sell another catastrophic war that it might not threaten us, but it threatens North Koreans. And it also threatens South Koreans and Japanese and millions of civilians. I mean, this has the potential of leading to a nuclear conflict. And the casual manner in which many media outlets and pundits and politicians are discussing a potential war, and the casual manner with which Donald Trump, the commander-in-chief of the largest military in the world, is threatening a foreign country on his Twitter account. These are all very dangerous developments, and there has not been nearly enough criticism or attention to what's going on.
When I said it at the beginning, it was a manufactured crisis. I believe it really is a manufactured crisis. I think the United States, well, here's a couple facts for our audience. North Korea offered to suspend all nuclear weapons tests and perhaps long-range missile tests in exchange for the United States canceling its participation in annual war exercises that simulate the destruction of North Korea, including the nuclear bombing of North Korea, to which the Trump administration said no. I mean, Obama said no the year before. I mean, North Korea is offering to suspend tests. Then the United States sends the USS Carl Vinson, and as Trump made the point, we're sending something even more dangerous, the Trident submarine, and it really is more dangerous. It can destroy, incinerate 24 North Korean cities instantly with the nuclear arsenal that it has on board, sending it to North Korea. And then North Korea issues like strongly worded statements saying we will punish our enemies. And then the U.S. media says, see how provocative North Korea is? See how they're talking? I mean, it's really Alice in Wonderland. Everything is turned upside down.
Absolutely. In many ways, I think it actually parallels the kind of reporting we see on Israel-Palestine, where there's a clear oppressor in this case, the U.S. government, in the case of Israel-Palestine, it's the occupying Israeli government, which is portrayed as the benevolent actor, and then responses of self-defense or responses to threats are portrayed as acts of aggression. So the U.S. as I mentioned, I mean, the leader on his Twitter account threatens to destroy North Korea. As you mentioned, the U.S. military working with South Korea right on, you know, the southern border of North Korea has military exercises that depict a potential destruction of the country. And then when they respond, it's portrayed as a threat. And there's also no historical context to any of this. Many media outlets in the U.S. and the West in general act as though Korea is, the DPRK is completely paranoid, as if it doesn't have any justifiable fears. But when you look at the history, the genocidal war that the U.S. carried out in that country, you know, in the early 1950s, this is not really taught much in schools anymore, but the U.S., according to its own officials, killed around 20% of the total population in the Korean War. And now we look at the DPRK, you know, this was only six or seven decades ago. It wasn't that long ago. And we treat this country as if it's this complete rogue state that has no reason to fear that the U.S. might turn it into Libya or turn it into Iraq. So the context for this is completely misleading. And again, when you look at the kind of media reports on North Korea, which are often incredibly racist, that treat the population as a bunch of ants, it really is disturbing.
Yeah, it is racist. I mean, even when we were demonstrating outside the White House yesterday, the people who were against us were coming up and yelling that the North Koreans were inbred and, you know, like racist stuff. I mean, just base racist kind of things. But of course, the U.S. media has treated North Korea in a caricatured, stereotypical way, you know, evidence of racism. And that works. I mean, that works at least with some parts of the population. Ben Norton, I want to talk to you again about this manufactured crisis because there's different elements of it. Trump has muted his critics in the Washington Post and the New York Times and CNN because now he's a great leader whenever he goes to war or threatens war. So he's got that formula down. That works. That mutes the critics. That makes them applaud rather than criticize him. The other thing is that inside of South Korea, an election is coming up. The Washington Post, even, which is a big supporter of THAAD, the Missile Defense Shield, is basically admitting yesterday in the news coverage that this rush to impose THAAD in the midst of this crisis atmosphere is really less about North Korea and more about the idea that South Koreans might elect somebody who's, I don't know, to the left.
No, absolutely. And this is an important point that's really little discussed. For historical reasons, of course, it actually partially makes sense because South Korea has in some ways been colonized by the U.S. I mean, after, again, the Korean Peninsula was completely destroyed in a genocidal war. But at the same time, although the South Korean government is very closely allied with the U.S., it's not – the South Korean people are not tools of the U.S., and they may pursue a different agenda. And when you look at the response, especially, you know, there have been massive protests in recent years, and especially in the past several months in South Korea, that led to the, you know, ousting of the president. So it's very possible that there could be a shift left. When you read media reports from South Korea, actually, certainly many media outlets are critical of North Korea, but the kind of hysteria that we see in the U.S. is not mirrored in the same way. And there's a possibility that, you know, that things could change on the ground. I think that's a good analysis. But also at the same time, I think the Trump administration has made a very clear shift. Steve Bannon, who is, of course, a horrific white supremacist and anti-Muslim bigot, but on foreign policy was not the kind of conventional hawk that many of these Pentagon officials are. He was kicked out of the National Security Council. And I think, I'm glad he was. I'm sure he should be kicked out of the government. But that demonstrates, among other actions, of course, the bombing of a Syrian government airbase earlier this month, that the Trump administration is moving toward a conventional Republican hardline bellicose foreign policy. And he's really letting many of these Pentagon officials call out of the shots and a lot of these hardline generals. And, you know, recently, in fact, on Wednesday, a top U.S. official said that they want to bring Korea to its senses. And we see a lot of this very bellicose rhetoric. So I think in many ways, it's not South Korea that's the aggressor. And there could potentially be some change in South Korea. It's the U.S. that's pushing this really belligerent policy.
Yeah, I want to read for our audience what the Washington Post, and the Washington Post is a big supporter of THAAD. That's the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, or the Missile Defense Shield that China and Russia are protesting against. The U.S. says it's against North Korea in the atmosphere of crisis with North Korea, but China says, well, look, it's really not about North Korea at all. North Korea can send low-altitude artillery pieces and missiles to South Korea and against U.S. troops in South Korea. It's really directed towards encircling China. But here's what the Post says. The sudden and unannounced move to urgently deploy THAAD only 6 days after the U.S. military command in South Korea secured the land to deploy the system, 6 days later, known as THAAD. Moon Jae-in, a liberal candidate who has a strong lead in the polls ahead of a May 9th presidential election, has promised to review South Korea's decision to host the anti-missile battery. He doesn't want it. He's against it, as are many, many people in South Korea. Quote, there's a sense in Seoul that THAAD deployment has been rushed based on the timetable of South Korea's presidential election rather than North Korea's threat, says John DeLuria, a professor of international relations at Yonsei University in South Korea. Quote, to some extent, the acceleration of THAAD deployment, again, that's all this week, has worked, limiting the next South Korean leader's room for maneuver. But, he adds, there is a danger of backlash among South Korean public feeling like a pawn in the game of America First. I mean, South Korea is a big country. It's the 10th biggest economy in the world. It's been, as you said, essentially a colony of the United States for a long time. But more and more public opinion matters in South Korea. And the South Koreans, like people everywhere, just don't want to be a pawn in somebody else's imperial chessboard.
Absolutely. And you put it very well. And it's always very interesting seeing these kinds of gems that are just, you have to dig through mainstream media outlets, but you can find them. And I'll add another thing here briefly. There was a very interesting article published in The Hill, an editorial by George Fisher. George Fisher is a professor of law who previously served as the assistant attorney general from Massachusetts. And in this article, he states very clearly that what the U.S. is doing is a, quote, barely veiled threat of preemptive attack. And he stressed that under international law, under the United Nations Charter, this is a complete violation of international law. This is an act of aggression and has no justification. And the U.S. saber rattling, again, as you just acknowledged, doesn't just threaten Americans. If anything, it threatens Koreans the most from both the North and the South. And the U.S. and the Trump administration, by pushing this extremely hawkish imperial policy, is putting the lives of millions of Koreans on the line. Because if this does escalate into a nuclear conflict, and God forbid that could be the end of the world, but if it does escalate to that level, even if it's not apocalyptic in the same way, it could result in the deaths of millions of Koreans. And that is something that every American should be protesting, that this is abominable and cannot be tolerated.
Donald Trump keeps putting pressure on Xi Jinping and the Chinese government and says, you solve this problem or we will, meaning if you don't solve it, we'll start a war. I mean, that's in essence what he's saying. It's a big threat against China. And China is really worried. 180,000 Chinese people died in the last Korean War. They were the Chinese volunteers. They drove the U.S. back below the 38th parallel along with North Korean military guerrilla units. About 180,000 people died, but it shares a border with North Korea. It's a historic relationship. They both have communist parties in their leadership. China, when you look at the unofficial media like Global Times, which is not the organ of the Communist Party of China, but reflects the real thinking of the Chinese Communist Party, it's become more and more alarmed and alarming and maybe alarmist in its tone. It's also warning North Korea, don't set off any more missile tests because the U.S. government really, truly is in a belligerent state and really, truly will go to war, and China can't stop this, and China can't be the guarantor of all things. They always say back to Trump, hey, we can't control North Korea. They're a sovereign country. They have more sovereignty than South Korea, which is undoubtedly true. But China's worried. China's foreign ministry responded to the deployment of THAAD with a statement that says, China strongly urges the United States and South Korea to stop actions that worsen regional tensions and harm China's strategic security interests and cancel the deployment of THAAD and withdraw the equipment. That's, they just issued that statement. Now you have Trump telling them, you take care of North Korea, break with your ally, and at the same time, yes, I'm going to rush the deployment of THAAD. That actually signals a threatening presence by the United States in the context of the Asia pivot against the People's Republic of China. And the Chinese government isn't really standing up to Trump. I mean, that maybe it's prudence, maybe they're being cautious, but they're not like laying down a line in the sand. Talk about what China should do or can do or is doing.
Yeah, well, I mean, honestly, I don't think we need to be asking much more of China. I mean, I think China has been a very level-headed actor in this. If you look at media reports, you know, the New York Times and others have portrayed China as complicit, as, you know, the ally of North Korea that's helping stifling these tensions. But really, I think when you look at what's happening, it's very clearly an act of aggression by the U.S., by the Trump administration, which, again, as you said, I mean, not only rhetorically, but has been militarily saber-rattling in extreme ways. And North Korea has been responding defensively to these threats. And then China has been the third party that is trying to de-escalate the situation, that is calling for diplomacy, that is doing anything it can to prevent military action. And I don't think we necessarily need to ask them to do more. They've been seemingly pretty reasonable in this conflict. The unreasonable actor is the Trump administration and President Trump himself, who is continuing to ramp up tensions needlessly, as you mentioned. I mean, what you use the term manufactured scandal. I mean, absolutely. But what is the scandal? I mean, when you look at media reports and the way they portray North Korea, it's as if it's simply assumed that everyone in the U.S. considers it a threat. The Trump administration keeps calling it a threat. But how is it a threat? Even if the Trump administration's foreign policy is predicated on this jingoist notion of America first, how is this actually threatening American national security? It's not.
I hear you. DPRK has not invaded any other country. The last time there was a war there was the Korean War, which was in Korea. They don't carry out drone strikes against other countries. They're not invading other places. That sort of conduct belongs to some other government that we're referring to, but it doesn't refer to North Korea. Rex Tillerson will chair a UN Security Council meeting on Friday in which the U.S. is expected to push for new harsh sanctions. We'll see what position China and Russia and the other Security Council members take. This is an ongoing crisis, Ben Norton. We're going to keep following it. We're out of time right now. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Donald Trump has released a tax plan. Well, it's not actually a tax plan, but it does propose sharp cuts for businesses and those who return overseas corporate profits to the U.S. But what does his tax plan mean for working people in the United States? We are joined from San Francisco by Daniel Sankey. He is a financial policy analyst. Welcome back, Daniel.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Not really a plan.
Not really a plan. It's a tax something. It's kind of interesting to see how Trump was elected on this really kind of anti-establishment basis. He was, you know, even hated by the GOP, his own party, it seemed, just as much as the Democrats at the time. And as the tax plan rolls out, it looks actually kind of traditional, sort of your typical kind of neoconservative, neoliberal policy of massive tax cuts for the extremely wealthy with little solutions or proposals for how gaps will be met in absence of all this tax revenue. And so that's what you're seeing now, where we're getting a number of different, you know, reports that are coming out about his proposals. But probably the biggest one that occupies the most of the news headlines is a suggestion to cut the corporate tax rate from 35% to 15%, which is a huge cut. You know, you don't have to be an economist or a mathematician to understand what a massive decrease that is. People have estimated that's approximately $2.4 trillion over the next decade or so. And that, of course, makes a lot of these extremely wealthy corporations very happy about the thought of this. But the problem is there doesn't seem to be a program or a solution to what we'll do to generate that extra $2.4 trillion, where that money will come from. Initially, there was some suggestions on his end that there would be import taxes that would supposedly help stimulate United States jobs. which unfortunately it looks like are being dropped. He's probably not going to do those, and it's likely under pressure from other large corporations like Walmart and Toyota, who have tons of imports that they sell here, who don't want to see their prices go up and then potentially hurt their bottom line. So it doesn't look like they're going to be generating revenue that way. And really, the plan doesn't seem to have a solution to how we're going to suddenly reduce all this revenue and without providing some other source of revenue.
Yeah, so what happens then? Okay, I mean, because the government has assets, it has liabilities. The taxes pay for revenue in the United States. A great part of the discretionary budget, that is the budget that's not tied to so-called entitlements like Medicare or Medicaid or Social Security, that discretionary budget goes to the military. And Trump is already saying, well, we're going to increase the military budget by $54 billion in 1 year during the next year, over what it is now, which is about $650 billion. That's the official Pentagon number. There's other military parts of the budget that are hidden in other agencies outside of the Department of Defense. But still, $54 billion, a big, big increase. So that money has to be taken from somewhere. And then you're going to cut huge parts of the national treasury because you're going to let corporate investors keep the money rather than have that money taxed if it's going from 35 to 15%. I mean, is it just a recipe for massive cuts of social services?
Yeah, it is really just a recipe for massive cuts of social services. What you're hearing from Trump and Steve Mnuchin, the Secretary of the Treasury, is that essentially, well, don't worry, the huge tax cut will pay for itself through economic growth. And what they're saying is, okay, the corporations now with this, you know, huge tax cut will suddenly start spending their money in the productive sector and increasing jobs and increasing the share given to the middle class. But the problem is, you know, this is an old refrain. We've been hearing this for decades. You know, it was more popularly known as Reaganomics back in the 80s. And the reality is, and a number of economists have said this, is that we would need a sustained growth rate of approximately 5% to make up that $2.4 trillion. And we haven't had that sort of growth rate for a very long time, at least not in a sustained way. It pops up every once in a while, but it's not a sustained growth rate. 5% is actually a quite high one. It's extremely unlikely that a huge tax cut will actually create this degree of growth. But of course, that's the promise that's being made. You can also see them kind of backpedaling. Trump on the campaign trail said, oh, he's going to create a 6% growth rate, which would be kind of unheard of. Now Mnuchin is saying, well, more like around 3%. But then other economists are saying it would need more like 5% to make that gap. So what's going to happen is there's going to be an increase in the deficit, and that's going to require more cutting to various government spending. And at least given how the administration has been shaping up so far, you can bet those cuts are not going to be to the Department of Defense. They're going to be to other social services as, you know, the government kind of is pushed and forced to chop away these other programs just to make up for this huge deficit that's been created.
Does the real estate sector benefit from the tax plan? I mean, does Donald Trump personally benefit from what he's proposing?
You know, it's interesting. He's actually created a little conflict between them in that he was thinking or suggesting, hinting at, that he would cut some of the real estate sector's most favored tax breaks, tax benefits, if you will. For example, deducting interest on loan payments or writing down the depreciation of assets. And there's been a big outcry. Honestly, I doubt that he will actually do that. I think this is like so many things, like kind of campaign rhetoric, although he's not campaigning anymore, where there's huge real estate interest, including his own, that would be hurt by these things. And I don't see that happening. What I do see them benefiting from, though, for sure, is the cut from the 35% to the 15%, because that's, you know, across the board, all sorts of different businesses will get to enjoy that decrease if it actually goes through, and that includes the real estate sector. So I don't see them taking back those kind of special interest taxes. I see them also keeping those on the book and also decreasing the 35% to 15%. Trump and other peoples in his industry will benefit hugely. And frankly, you know, almost all corporations will. That tax rate cut isn't just to certain types of businesses, it's across the board, including what's kind of popularly known as pass-through corporations, better known as like hedge funds and investment firms. So these firms will also be getting a significant tax credit. They already benefit from a variety of different tax loopholes and laws, especially considering so much of their capital is international. So I don't really actually see him backpedaling on any of those. I think that he'll kind of stick to those things that benefit his industry and industries like his.
I mean, there are huge problems with the U.S. tax system. Major U.S. corporations, even though the corporate tax rate is 35%, they just avoid those taxes because they set up shop officially somewhere else, like Apple Corporation, for instance. They don't pay taxes because they say they're not an American company. They're an offshore company. They have, I don't know whether they're in Ireland or the Cayman Islands or wherever they are, but they actually don't pay taxes. They say they're an overseas company. They don't have to repatriate the money, although the money actually never leaves like New York City banks. I mean, it's just a bookkeeping thing. And Trump says, well, if we lower the official corporate tax rate, then some of this money that's being not taxed at all because it's being sheltered in overseas sort of shell companies by Apple Company, Apple Corporation, and many, many, many other U.S., major U.S. corporations, that they will start to bring the money back. And he says there will be a one-time tax that will allow people who haven't paid taxes in the past to at a lower rate. In other words, that this will be a boon to the U.S. Treasury because it'll stop the offshoring of companies. What do you think about that?
Well, I think we need to be smart and understand what's really happening here. If he does that and allows them to repatriate those funds at a record low tax rate, then they will take advantage of that and they will bring the funds back home. The rest of U.S. citizens won't, of course, benefit nearly as much because of, again, the taxes won't be collected. They'll be quite low. However, what the argument they're trying to make, and this is your typical kind of conservative argument, is that, well, they'll bring all this money home and then they'll use it to create jobs and it'll trickle down. And the reality is what's going to happen if Apple, for example, brings home those funds is what they're probably going to do is use it to prop up their stock price with big stock buybacks. They're going to use it to pay dividends out to their shareholders. And essentially, it's just going to move those repatriated funds to top-level executives and very wealthy investors who have put a lot of money with Apple. What you're not going to see is Apple opening up a whole bunch of new Apple stores, for example, or somehow bringing manufacturing over here. That's not going to happen. It's not going to trickle down that way. We even saw this, for example, after the 2008 crisis, because of the bank bailouts, the banks were sitting on massive amounts of capital. They had huge amounts of capital. And the logic was, oh, they'll take all this money, they'll make loans, they'll stimulate the economy, they'll stimulate consumer spending, they'll stimulate, you know, small and mid-sized businesses with loans, and it'll boost the economy. But instead, what they did with those funds is they invested them in a variety of complex financial instruments and financial speculations, because the reality was those were far more profitable than investing in the domestic production sector. And Apple's going to do the same sorts of things. It's going to be kicks up to executives, or it's going to be investing in various financial instruments. But you're not going to see it trickle down to working class people, and you're not going to see this, you know, big return of jobs.
We're speaking with Daniel Sankey. He's a financial policy analyst about Donald Trump's tax plan, which, again, is not a plan. It's just a bunch of bullet points at this point. I guess he wanted to get it out there, Daniel, before the 100-day mark so that he could say he has another, like a notch in his belt that, you know, bomb Syria, tax plan, you know, whatever. But let's talk about the real world for real people who are not living in sort of beltway politics or Donald Trump's talking points or whatever. I want to go back to the point that you made that the banks and the corporations, because it was corporations too, like General Motors, like Ford, were bailed out. The government gave them huge amounts of money. I mean, in the case of the financial sector, $660 billion, no strings attached. The government gave them the money. The government then engaged in quantitative easing, basically printing money, giving it to the banks. The banks were allowed to do with it whatever they wanted to do, which was not to create jobs. It was to, you know, gamble at that casino called the stock exchange, and stock prices are soaring through the roof. There's a huge stock bubble. But for average people, as a consequence of the way this capitalist system works, because the money goes to the bankers and they decide, it's their decision, or the corporations, they decide what to do. In the case of the auto companies, they ripped up the auto contracts, the UAW contracts, which had the force of law, but apparently not. The situation with working folks is not that great. In fact, it's very bad. The unemployment rate last month fell to 4.5% in March. That's the lowest level since the May of 2007. But the employment to population ratio also edged up to 60.1%. That means for every 100 people, adults who could be working, 60 are actually working. In other words, 40% are not working. And that's a new high for an economic recovery, but still more than 3% points below the pre-recession level. In other words, the number of people working compared to those who can't find work is actually still lower than it was in 2007.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in many ways, it's a lost decade for working class people, where wages have stagnated or gone down, and employment is not even back to the way it was before. It's kind of a break even. Whereas, of course, on the corporate side, there's been record profits. You know, earlier you mentioned, Brian, about the record highs on the stock exchanges, which is true. And what you're seeing is this total disconnect between what's happening on the financial side, what's happening with the stock exchanges, what's happened with the multi-billionaire corporations, and what's happening to the rest of U.S. citizens in day-to-day life. And what's happening is this total disconnect. On one side, you see record profits, record highs, massive speculation. And on the other side, you just see stagnation. You know, once upon a time, there was this huge industrial sector as America transformed into an industrial economy. That's long since over. And what we're seeing now is where that kind of gets floated around called financialization as opposed to industrialization. And we're seeing our economy transform from a productive economy, which, you know, still had all the contradictions and problems of capitalism, but in general benefited working class people in that many of them could have their labor absorbed by these massive industrial plants. Now, in financialization, we're seeing a transformation of the economy into a largely banking economy with complex financial instruments, complex financial speculation. It's global. It's all over the world. And it doesn't require the same type of workforce or benefit the same type of people. A small group of investors can manage billions of funds. You don't need the hundreds of thousands of people to benefit, you know, the industrial sector as it was, say, in the 60s. And you've seen that transformation, and it continues. It's rolling forward. No amount of tax cuts are going to suddenly transform that. That's just not possible. And so this bailout, they know this tax cuts, they know what this means. The people that are proposing it, like Trump and the Secretary of the Treasury, know this. And so it's just, you know, it's just a free tax holiday for them and their friends who are also multi-billionaires.
Daniel Sankey, we have about 2 minutes left, maybe 90 seconds. What happened to the promised border adjustment tax? Mnuchin said, quote, "We don't think it works in its current form, and we're going to continue to have discussions with them," meaning congressional leaders, "about revisions that they will consider." Real quick, what is that? That was a key part of what Trump was promising for his tax plan. What is the border adjustment tax, and what will happen to it?
So it was a tax that would essentially tax imports. So countries that were selling us various products, usually at very cheap cost because their labor costs are so low, it would be a tax to kind of artificially inflate the price. And in return, U.S. domestic economy would start being able to produce these same commodities competitively, right, for a comparable or even better price. What happened to this tax is companies like Walmart and Toyota fought it tooth and nail. And these are companies with real political power, real capital. I think I mentioned this on a earlier episode of yours where I said, I just can't see Trump taking on these companies and winning. And the reality is that's exactly what happened. He maybe took them on in some kind of half-baked rhetoric during his campaign, but in a real substantial way, absolutely not. And they would not allow this to happen. That would hurt their bottom line. That would hurt their profitability. And they made sure it got sunk. And so you see Steve Mnuchin kind of quietly stepping away from that and saying, oh, well, it doesn't work. It's in its current form. And the reality is they're not going to try to push anything like that forward. Those corporations simply won't let them.
All right. We want to thank Daniel Sankey for his insight. Daniel, we'll continue to talk to you as the tax plan becomes something more than just talking points as we see how it actually develops as a legislative proposal. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. The semi-annual summit of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, begins today in Manila and is a milestone in President Rodrigo Duterte's controversial presidency. We are joined from New York by Bernadette Ellerin, the chairperson of Bayan USA. Welcome back, Bernadette.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for joining. The ASEAN summit opens today in Manila. It will take place over 3 days in which the leaders of the 10 countries of the association will be present. How important is the summit and what should we be watching for?
It's going to be the 30th meeting of the ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, this time headed by, like you said, President Rodrigo Duterte of the Philippines. For Bayan, we are preparing to hold demonstrations during the summit because the summit, by and large, is the purpose of the summit is to basically expand the role of the Southeast Asian region as an investment area and production hub for large corporations in the U.S., China, Japan, South Korea, and the European Union. And it's going to equate to economic despair for a majority of the peoples in the region, especially in the Philippines.
So how will the Duterte government or how is the Duterte government reacting to the idea of people demonstrating in Manila against the summit or against its economic policies or both? Obviously, for Duterte, he has a lot at stake. He wanted to be the host of this summit. Talk about the government's reaction to the demonstrations, if you would.
Sure. Well, this is an area of policy where the anti-imperialist mass movement represented by Bayan and the Duterte administration do not see eye to eye. Unfortunately, while he had some rhetoric early on in his presidency around economic sovereignty and not bowing down to foreign dictates, particularly U.S. dictates, his economic thrusts have continued on with the neoliberal economic paradigm. And that's what this ASEAN summit and his position in ASEAN represents. So I think we have yet to see the president's reaction or response to the mounting protests that are happening right now in the Philippines, in Manila, for this summit.
How big are the protests or how big do you expect them to be?
I mean, I'm not on the ground in Manila right now, but Bayan, just for people's reference, Bayan is an alliance of millions of members, thousands of organizations, millions of members representing mainly urban, poor, rural, and industrial worker groups, the groups that represent those who are the most burdened by neoliberal economic policies in the Philippines. So if Bayan calls for a full mobilization, we could see, you know, maybe anywhere from tens of thousands on the streets today in Manila.
The New York Times yesterday, the day before the summit began, had a lead editorial or a main editorial called "Let the World Condemn Duterte." Under the editorial, there's a picture of a woman, a young woman, the caption is a 17-year-old, a few hours after she was killed by masked gunmen in the Philippines in 2016. And then the Times I'll read you the first paragraph. A Filipino lawyer formally asked the International Criminal Court on Monday to charge President Rodrigo Duterte and 11 officials with mass murder and crimes against humanity over the extrajudicial killings of thousands of people in the Philippines over the past 3 decades. The ICC should promptly open a preliminary investigation of the killings. Now, the timing of the criminal referral or criminal complaint or request, that can't be accidental. And certainly the New York Times editorial isn't accidental either. It's published on the eve of a summit that Duterte is holding. Talk about the contradictory nature of Duterte's orientation towards the U.S. and this mounting chorus in the United States to label Duterte, because of his drug policy, a war criminal and someone who should be referred to the ICC, which, of course, would take it outside the realm of Filipino sovereignty. Go ahead.
I want to start my answer by saying that Bayan condemns the extrajudicial killings related to Duterte's so-called war on drugs. That being said, extrajudicial killings have been happening in the Philippines under most of the administrations prior to Duterte, and there has been no level of international media attention under the Arroyo and Aquino administrations as there are now under Duterte. I think we also have to examine the role of the media and the particular narrative that the media is crafting in terms of what's happening in the Philippines right now. There has been no coverage, absolutely no coverage of the Philippine peace process, you know, despite the fact that there's wall-to-wall coverage of Duterte's drug war and wall-to-wall condemnation of it. And we're not condoning it, but the media is not presenting a balanced view of the objective situation in the Philippines. And that needs to be pointed out. I think the peace process is also important to examine because the peace process also shows aspects of the Duterte administration that we view as non-adversarial, as pro-people, particularly openness and recognition of the dual state power situation in the Philippines. There is another government in the Philippines being born out of an armed revolutionary movement in the countryside that none of the previous administrations in the Philippines has recognized. Duterte is the first Philippine president to recognize it and to negotiate with it. And I think that needs to be said. I think part of the negotiations, too, is addressing the roots of the armed conflict, of which is poverty. And while this ASEAN summit will push neoliberal economic policies that will aggravate and worsen poverty, not only in the Philippines, but throughout the ASEAN region, which is largely agricultural, the Duterte administration is in negotiations right now with the National Democratic Front on the Philippines to implement its promise of free distribution of land to farmers in the Philippines. And so there's a lot of contradictions here. You're very, very right, Brian. But I think we have to have a holistic view of what's happening in the region. And right now, the media is not helping, I think. It's true. There's an ongoing problem of extrajudicial killings, and we condemn that. But the media has to also talk about the other policy of Duterte that is actually helping people on the ground in the Philippines.
I hear you on that. I think it's the height of hypocrisy, the height of double standard. Here you have the U.S. government, which has used the Filipino military as an extension of Pentagon power, and they've been carrying out a death squad policy against people fighting for land reform in the countryside. The very thing that led to the armed uprising itself, the armed struggle itself in the late 1960s. In other words, the ultimate need for poor farmers and landless farmers to defend themselves, not simply to initiate an armed struggle for a revolutionary takeover, but for the very elementary need to defend oneself. And during that entire time, the New York Times was completely mute. There wasn't a word of criticism of the Filipino government. And in fact, the New York Times supported all of that. So again, I want the audience to look at this, and not because of support for any of Duterte's policies as it affects the drug question, but the politics behind the United States, which sees in Duterte perhaps some sort of differentiation for a country that's a key country, a critically important country, a large country, and a country that had been a colony of the United States, starting to exercise some degree of independence from the empire. And as a consequence, Duterte becomes a target for the empire. I mean, that's the way I see it anyway.
Yeah, if I could just add, Brian, that I think the bigger context, too, is that the mainstream media, which, of course, serves the interests of big corporations, delivers a narrative that's dangerous, that conditions largely American audiences, you know, to see every situation in black and white, to see the world as a world of heroes and villains, when that is just not the objective truth on the ground, you know. And for us to digest that narrative is dangerous because it drums up the justification for more intervention, you know, intervention on poor countries like the Philippines and other and in the region because of what we perceive to be a war between heroes and villains. And there's no room for gray area. And I think it's a dangerous narrative that the media is towing right now. And it's not helping the American people, especially because now there's $54 billion tax dollars that have been added to the military industrial complex to launch wars of aggression and strikes, you know, all over the world, including in the Asia-Pacific region. So we have to really be more critical in how we receive our information from the media.
I agree with you. Can you enlighten the audience, also help us understand what seems to be the contradictory position or ambiguous position of the Philippine government towards China? When Duterte was in China, he said, we have to break free from the United States. We're an independent country. He signaled the Chinese that not only would there be a large number of economic agreements, but that the Philippines wanted to have friendly relations with China, not adversarial relations with China, while at the same time retaining and defending Philippine sovereignty. But since then, there have been other signs that seem to indicate that Duterte was moving back in a traditional direction, say the same, not the same, but in the direction of where the Aquino government was in its hostility towards China. How do we understand the ambiguity or the contradictoriness of Duterte's position regarding China?
Sure. Well, I'll start off by saying that our view in Bayan is that we're living in an increasingly multipolar world in terms of big monopoly capitalist superpowers. And right now, both China and Russia are seen as threats to U.S. hegemony all over the world, especially in the Asia-Pacific region, especially in the ASEAN region. I think Duterte recognizes that posturing. And right now, while he in the beginning took a firm position in rhetoric to distance the Philippines away from the U.S. as an empire, he is still not standing up for genuine economic sovereignty and self-reliance of the Philippines when he entertains possible partnerships with China, unless whatever these negotiations result to still maintain and recognize economic sovereignty in the Philippines. And we have yet to see that. We have yet to still see a lot of things. The situation is still unfolding and developing as we speak.
Duterte seems like a strong leader, very strong as an individual personality. Of course, you know, when we look at systems, we look at personalities, we don't discount them, but they're, of course, in the context of larger systems and larger centers of power and networks of power. And those power centers are not simply within the borders of a single country. They're international as well, at least in our current epoch. Does some of the swinging back and forth or ambiguity or contradictoriness of Duterte's position relate to his relationship with the Philippine military, which in turn has been for a long time the product of, you know, an extension really of Pentagon power?
Yeah, well, the Philippine military, it was created by the U.S. government, to be perfectly frank about it. Historically, the Philippine military right now, the armed forces of the Philippines right now, is an extension of the Philippine constabulary that was established by the U.S. colonial, during the U.S. colonial period, for the purpose of repressing resistance to U.S. colonialism in the Philippines at the time. So the Philippine military, the AFP, the Armed Forces of the Philippines, continues on with that same role. It basically is there to serve the interests of the U.S. in the Philippines by maintaining a neocolonial state, essentially. And I think people have to realize that that the Philippine military is very, very well funded by the U.S. government, and millions of tax dollars from the U.S. flow to train and arm and advise the Philippine military. And that is why the Philippine military is the most reactionary, most neo-colonial institution in the Philippines right now. It has the power actually to oust presidents. So there are militarists, there are hardcore militarists and factions within the Philippine military right now that are pressuring Duterte to toe the traditional line of U.S. puppetry, which I think Duterte is trying to navigate through. I think these militarists within the administration, coming mainly from the Armed Forces of the Philippines, were behind the February statement of Duterte himself reaffirming the CPP-NPA and Chief Political Consultant Jose Maria Sison as terrorists, and what led to what seemed to be a breakdown of the peace process, but was later resumed back in April. So I think there is this tug of war right now that Duterte himself has to navigate through, because while he may be a contradictory and controversial figure with, you know, who says a lot of things that may seem anti-imperialist, the reality is the Philippines is a neocolonial state, and the Philippine military is there to ensure that.
Indeed. We have one final minute. The Saigon newspaper, which is the official Communist Party of in Vietnam of the Ho Chi Minh City, said about Vietnamese Foreign Minister Pham Binh Minh's trip to the United States, where he met with Rex Tillerson and McMaster, this national security advisor. While comparing notes on regional and international issues, Tillerson and McMaster underlined the importance of maintaining peace, stability, security, safety, and freedom of navigation in the EC. The U.S. supports the settlement of disputes in the sea by peaceful measures based on diplomatic and legal processes in line with international law, especially the 1982 United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea and the Declaration on the Conduct of Parties in the EC, they stressed. That's from the Vietnamese Communist Party. In your opinion, last minute, is the U.S. still trying to put together an anti-China alliance in Southeast Asia? Will Philippines, will Vietnam go along with that kind of plan?
So the quick answer is yes. The U.S. is using this line that it must contain China or this anti-China line to justify its increased militarization of the region. You have to understand that the Asia-Pacific region is home to the U.S. Pacific Command. And that's the largest of the regional commands of the U.S. military, of the U.S. armed forces. And it's mainly naval. The reason why there are so many bases in the Pacific, in the Asia Pacific, is because the Asia Pacific region is the largest market for U.S. imports. So it's a big investment area for and production hub for U.S. corporations, U.S. banks, U.S. firms. And that's really the reason why we are experiencing this continued so-called pivot to Asia, when really the first pivot to Asia was the Philippine-American War in 1898. You know, that's when the U.S. as an imperialist power came into the region and set up shop there militarily and never left until this day. So that's really what's behind this so-called pivot to Asia, this so-called war with containment with China. It really is for the U.S. to ensure and flex its military might to ensure that it can maintain its economic hegemony in the region, because it has trillions of dollars invested in the region.
Okay. We're going to have to leave it there. We're completely out of time. We've been joined from New York by Bernadette Ellerine. She is the chairperson of BION. You can go to their website, bionusa.org. BION is B-A-Y-A-N, USA.org. Thank you, Bernadette. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and clear.